Hello, I'm Kara Dahl Russell. So happy to be here today with pianist Martin Berkowski. Most recently, you, our listeners, have known of him through a Beethoven work that we've played from one of his CDs, Beethoven's Fantasy for Piano, Orchestra, and Chorus, which is very reminiscent to Beethoven's Ninth, obviously a precursor. It's been requested by you after we first opened it on Just Opened, and I have Martin Berkowski here with me today. Hi, Martin.
Whoa, hello. It's wonderful to be here.
It's very nice to have you here. I'm glad you could take time out of your busy schedule to be with us. Martin now has two new releases, one which we've had on the shelf and just haven't gotten on Just Opened yet, works by Franz Liszt, and still in the plastic wrapper, a new CD of works by Alan Hovhaness. You just got this recording completed, the Hovhaness?
Well, the recordings were completed actually years ago, but the idea to put all of these were recordings made in Moscow, to put them all together, I had the idea about a year ago, and some were are a re-release, some are new.
Okay.
And since we just passed the 100th anniversary of Alan Hovhaness, I wanted this to be a tribute to Alan Hovhaness, who was probably the most wonderful mentor that I had ever had.
Oh, wonderful. And that's a little behind the scenes. Sometimes that's the way these CDs are put together. People mm-hmm. think you just go in and record it all from beginning to end, but sometimes it's picked and taken from here and there and other recordings and put together in a CD. Why don't we back up a little bit and talk about how you got started on the piano, where you're from, and how you got started.
Oh, gosh. I was born in Washington, D.C., not all that far from here, and lived my early years actually in Maryland. But my parents were music lovers and amateur musicians. There was always music in the house, and I can remember just as the youngest kid hearing music, I would, when I could reach the keys on the piano, walk up and reach my hands up to the keys and try picking out things that I had heard on the radio, playing by ear or whatever. And it just all happened that way. And it was wonderful.
And I believe you said that shortly after that you started taking lessons and that your first public recital on television was around the age of 8?
Well, I sure wasn't ready for it. And I don't know if anyone else was, but it happened. And There I was, and I was supposed to be playing some kind of Beethoven, and don't have the faintest idea how I did it or how awful it must have been, but it happened.
Tell me a little bit about, then, your career from there, and I know you've made some comments about how focused you were on the career and what that did to you as a person.
Oh, gosh. I don't wish this on anybody else, because, you know, you get this idea from a very early age, and especially it gets into your conservatory curriculum. You must succeed at any cost. So you become public enemy number one. You know, there's no concert hall manager, no conductor, no symphony manager, no recording executive, no radio station announcer who is safe from you, because you're out to make it at any cost, to push yourself and, you know, I'm going to be rich and famous and all of the above quicker than anybody else. And it's just an awful, awful way to live.
You did say it was quite successful, though, right? You said you made recordings with several large symphonies.
Well, before I reached the age of 30, I was already recording with the London Symphony Orchestra, the Berlin Symphony Orchestra. And many times I've said, I wish I could hit the delete key on those recordings. I mean, they were professional. They're, you know, loud and soft and fast and slow and enough of the right notes to pass. But as we always like to say, the spaces between the notes weren't right. The person who was playing the notes wasn't right. It was a me first, the music second.
I've heard this from many other musicians, and that they listen to their old recordings and they say, well, it's very fast. It's accurate and it's fast, but there's not much else there.
Yeah, well, for me, if I have to listen back, and I try to avoid it now, except when I want to remind myself of what not to do, it's rather ghastly.
And then some things happen to you in your outside of music life, or it's all integrated, but that sort of changed your mindset?
Well, it was the best and most wonderful thing that could have happened to me. I left my independent artist life. I was living, well, I guess you call it the penniless bohemian life in Paris for several years, and met a lovely blonde-haired, blue-eyed pianist from Iceland, and got the idea that I was going to become married, as it were, once again, and live in Iceland and have this idyllic life. So at the same time, I was a motorcycle rider. Not a healthy thing, but it was sure fun while it lasted. I took the motorcycle to Iceland with me, and one day, coming home from a day of teaching at one of the music schools, somebody came out into the road in front of me, wasn't looking, and I ended up flat on my back in the hospital in Reykjavik for the next 4 months. My right leg, right ankle was completely broken through. My right arm was broken, they said, in about 8 different places, and they put it together with a metal bar and some nuts and bolts and funny-looking things. And, of course, at that point, I was asking the doctors, now, how soon before the bones heal? I've got to get out of here. I just canceled a big tour to the Middle East. And they kind of look at me and said, well, the muscles take a long time to heal. And I got the message.
Did they go so far as to tell you you might not play again at that point?
Well, they didn't want to cause me any more is the word discomfort then. but I got the message. So I did all kinds of impossible things. I invented exercises for myself because I had also dislocated the right elbow and couldn't even bend it enough to bring a spoon or a fork to my mouth to eat. And I had to learn to write left-handed, rather badly at that point. But this amazing thing happened. Already, you know, when you're flat on your back for some weeks in a hospital bed, you start getting the chance to do a little bit of reflection and some good thinking. And I thought, this life is killing me. I'm not really playing all that well. I'm not sounding any different from anybody else, or maybe a lot worse than everybody else. I don't know. I don't know how it has to be, but it has to change. And slowly the idea was kind of coming to me that I've got to get out of this hustling business because it's not right, it's not healthy, and the results aren't good. The turning point, I suppose, was Christmas Day of 1982, and my then wife was in the hospital room with me. It was, well, early afternoon, of course, early afternoon up in that latitude, the sun has already set. And she walked over to the window, and suddenly she started shaking, and like, well, I can't illustrate that on the radio very well, but
his hands are shaking,
yeah,
violently.
But whatever got into her, a few seconds later, jumped into me, and first it went through like a warmth, an energy, a power, I don't know how to describe it better. It went through my leg, through all the broken places, and went out the foot. And then it went into my arm and kind of whoosh, like, and went through all the broken places on the arm. And I thought, Martin, you've really lost it now. You're in big trouble. Call the men in the white coats. Have them take you away, because this is it. That's the end. Then I looked up at my wife and I asked her, have I really lost it? Have I really gone crazy? And she said, no, I felt the same thing. You're not crazy. And okay, that's it. I got to change my life and I know what to do. And it was just this idea that get out of the hustling business, try to give the concerts to benefit any kind of charities or good causes, make the recordings as much as possible for that reason, make your modest living by being a simple piano teacher, which is very rewarding in itself. Sometime after that, the casts came off, and I sat down at an old upright piano in the hospital, and except for the fact I didn't have the calluses on my fingers anymore, I played. The first thing was the second St. Francis legend of Franz Liszt, St. Francis of Paolo walking across the Straits of Messina, as the story goes. And it was as though I had never had an accident, never stopped practicing for a number of months. It was just all there, and I knew that that shouldn't be. That's not right. That shouldn't have happened under normal reasons. And I thought, okay, well, I know what I have to do. This is it. And how lucky I have been. So the first benefit concert was at the National Theater in Reykjavik.
And was that the birth of the Cristofori Foundation?
Well, the Cristofori Foundation was kind of the on-paper realization of trying to do this. But the first thing was just start living that life. You know, you don't need a corporate identity to hide behind. Just try to, you know, be the real thing and wake up every day and ask God, please don't let me be a fake anymore. Let me be the real thing. And that's that kind of gets you off to a pretty good start. And you have to think of other things too. Instead of thinking of piano competitions and beat the other guy, you have a new way of a new kind of set of buzzwords, and you begin the day by saying love the world and everything in it, and then you're off in the right direction. And
it does bear mentioning here, the Cristofori Foundation is a foundation that you've set up, that your concerts are benefits. All the proceeds go to that, is that correct?
And then, yeah, well, I...
And they help various groups, burn victims, cancer patients.
It could be any good cause at all, or just to support any wonderful music which is not normally performed, recorded, or brought out. Just if it's good, try to do it. And if it's self-serving, shoot yourself before you make another mistake.
And you are actually working pretty regularly with a couple other, pardon me if I say this wrong, Atakan Sari?
Yes, Atakan Sari is a wonderful young Turkish pianist who came to me. I first heard him play in Turkey, and he was playing in a masterclass that I was giving. And ultimately, thanks to his teacher, who actually was also one of my former students when I was teaching in Turkey, living in Turkey.
Oh.
We arranged for him to come here, attend my master classes. We then arranged a sponsorship for him to study at the Manhattan School of Music, and later he went on to get a graduate degree at the Ithaca College. But he is a wonderful, quiet, devoted, modest young man of the highest personal and musical credentials. And it worked out, just maybe not so much by coincidence, but can we say providence, that ultimately he became the first Turkish soloist ever to perform with the Armenian Philharmonic.
Ah.
And made a wonderful, wonderful success out of this, opened diplomatic doors. And it couldn't have been any better. I don't know if I've gotten a little bit ahead of the story, though.
We can take it where it goes.
Okay.
If you think we got ahead of it, where's the part that we? What's the part we skipped?
Well, I suppose, how did I end up being
playing
with
again.
The Armenian Philharmonic, and where did that all develop? Should I go off on that line for a moment?
Sure.
I had the most wonderful good fortune to, early in my life, this is 1971, meet the composer, Armenian-American composer, Alan Hovhaannis. He came to a concert that my ensemble, then the Long Island Chamber Ensemble, was giving in the, then it was called Carnegie Recital Hall before it was renamed to the Weill Recital Hall. And we were playing a little piece of his for soprano, clarinet, and piano called O Lady Moon. And he was so happy. He came backstage and talked with us. It was a great surprise. And we started talking, and he said, well, I think I'll write you a larger piece for that same combination. And was it a month or two later, a big copy from manuscript came. And as he later explained, he said, well, the first time I only went to the moon, so I decided that this piece should be called Saturn. And out of that developed a complete concert, a New York concert of his works. And it just went on to a wonderful working together. He had asked us to record this cantata, Saturn, and one of his piano concertos, Caldus, for piano, four trumpets, and percussion, for his newly formed Poseidon Society, his own recording label. And it was an amazing thing, because we were, you know, kids, relatively speaking. I was 28 years old. Larry Sobel, who was the co-director, was a few years younger than I. And Alan was going back and forth to London, recording with prestigious English symphonies, and then asking us kids at the same time to record for him. We kept in touch all the time when we both completed our, we call it our New York years or New York suffering. He went on to live in Seattle. I went on to live in Paris. I like to call it the penniless bohemian life. But we talked the whole time. We corresponded. We wrote letters. We always kept in touch. I was always getting wonderful advice from him on every level, from music, inspiration, the spiritual, advice on girlfriends, and we covered all the subjects very well. But he had, during those early, the New York years, I call them, given me a copy from his score of a concerto for two pianos and orchestra. And he said, I wrote this in 1954 for a two-piano team that separated. They never played it. It's not recorded. It's not published. And parenthetically, he said they never paid him for the commission. But I had, just before that, recorded the Max Bruch concerto for two pianos and orchestra with the London Symphony. So it was kind of coming on the tail of that. He said, well, here's another two-piano concerto. Do you think you can do anything with it? Well, I had about 30 years of disappointments, broken promises. Conductors would back out. Second pianists would give up or run away. And just by coincidence, when I was many years later in Turkey, giving this master class where this young gentleman, Atakan Sarı, was playing, I met a wonderful conductor, Konstantin Krimets, the Russian conductor. We were doing a couple of performances of the Emperor Concerto with the, it was called Chukarova State Symphony in Adana. And all, you know, because I'm always thinking of ideas, spur-of-the-moment ideas. So one of the first things I asked the maestro was, listen, well, can you listen to a student here, a young Turkish pianist? I think he's really got something, and I'd like you to hear him. And he was very generous, and he said, yes, yeah, I'll do it. And he, the young man played for him and received a very complimentary response. And then I kind of took it one step further, and I asked Konstantin, Maestro Klimets, I said, I have this two-piano concerto of Alan Hovhaness. It's never been recorded before. And he said, I have a wonderful recording orchestra in Moscow. Give me a score, let me look at it, and I'll tell you what I think. And I had the score sent to him. I got an answer back saying, I'm very interested to record this piece. It would be a world premiere recording. Yes. And this developed out of it. We went. I went with the young man, Atakan Sarı. At that point, he already, we had brought him to the USA to be in my master classes and then to study further at the Manhattan School of Music. We recorded the piece in Moscow. The recording went so wonderfully, I then took it one step further and asked our Maestro, what do you think of doing a world premiere of the piece here in Moscow? And he said, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do it. And we made the arrangements to have the world premiere in Tchaikovsky Hall, Moscow. The concert was partially sponsored and publicized by the Armenian embassy, since Alan Hovhaness is Armenian-American. And these wonderful people came backstage afterwards, shook Atakan Sar's hand, even spoke to him a few words in Turkish, and told him, please, you must come and play this piece with the Armenian Philharmonic. We did that. It was about a year and a half, 2 years later. We came to Yerevan, played the Armenian premiere of the work with the Armenian Philharmonic. Atakan Sara was the first Turkish soloist ever to perform with the Armenian Philharmonic. It was a landmark performance. It was videotaped, televised by Armenian state television. It opened fantastic doors. After that came the Turkish-Armenian, they say football, we say soccer game. There are artistic exchanges now between the two countries of string quartets. We have a long way to go, but we've started, and this is the most important thing. Alan Hovhaness taught me so much. He wrote a most wonderful symphony, Symphony No. 11, which he entitled All Men Are Brothers. What could be more correct and more noble and more proper than to think that way? Oh, end of the saga.
And we're talking now about stories related to this CD, Alan Hovhaness, Martin Berkovsky, the historic Moscow recordings. I did want to mention, before we go too far, you sort of come to us today by way of a group called Corporate Angels. Is that the correct name?
That's right. Corporate Angel is a wonderful network of volunteers. I think they are in Westchester County, New York, who have made contact with a number of the wonderful corporations across our country that any time that they are flying their corporate jets on a regularly scheduled trip that they have, and they want to donate an empty seat or two on the plane, in my case, to cancer patients who are flying to or from treatment at the hospitals. They very wonderfully do that. So
Returning from treatment in Oklahoma.
I'm returning from treatment at Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Tulsa, Oklahoma, right now. And these wonderful people from Corporate Angel called and said, we have a corporation, and many times the corporations are so modest and self-effacing that they don't want public publicity. They just are doing a wonderful good deed. But I ended up here in Salisbury last night, and I will take a bus later to go back home to Virginia. But through these wonderful people, I've ended up here, and I'm so happy that I can be here and meeting everybody today.
And we'll thank them through that name, through Corporate Angel. And that's a good name for people to know about who might be going through their own cancer treatment, that's a group that,
exactly,
that helps people make it to and from treatment centers. And one of the many resources for people as they're getting treatment and recovering from cancer.
Thank you.
I'm just very privileged and happy to be able to speak to you today. And I should say that Martin made the point of calling me and saying, I'm in town. I really want to make this work. And I'm the grateful recipient of that. Thank you so much. And if you would like to say just a little more about the Cristofori Foundation, you said something about the creator of the piano.
I was looking around to give a name for this, and suddenly it just popped into my mind, well, why shouldn't it be the inventor of the piano, Cristofori? It seemed right, and nobody else had taken the name yet, so I wasn't under copyright restriction or whatever you call it in this funny legal world.
And the website is
Christofori.org.
Oh, Christofori.org.
Yeah. It's okay. A very simple website. I haven't even updated it lately because I've been going...
Traveling.
Oklahoma to Washington to Oklahoma to Washington, I think about 30 times in the last 2 years.
But people can get your CDs there, is that correct, through the website?
A few of them, but actually the latest, the Havana CD... is being distributed through Crystal Records, which is a major distributor of Alan Havana CDs, and they've been doing just wonderful things for his music. And otherwise, I think we talked about the Beethoven CD.
Which our listeners have heard several times now.
So drop us an email. They can use hope@christofori.org. And Christofori is without an H, everybody. It's CRISTOFORI.org. And I'll be glad to make arrangements to make sure that people get copies of this.
Okay. And just remind us once again, what's the imprimatur of the foundation?
Purpose, raison d'etre. It just was to put on paper all the things I was already trying to do. Mm-hmm. That is, just use music for the best purposes possible, to help charities, to bring out music of composers that's not necessarily brought out. You know, you don't need a corporate logo or a corporate name to do that. You can do it. And I think the only problem in my case is that you can't do it in secret, because you have to walk out on stage and actually be seen and heard. And I would much rather wish you could just do it and, you know, go riding off into the sunset, and somebody would say, "Who's that masked
random
man?"
Random acts of music.
I like it. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to be with us, for making this happen.
Well, thank you.
Thanks to piano virtuoso Martin Berkowski. Thank you so much, Martin.
Thank you.
I should mention that Martin told me he has an event coming up next April in Oxon Hill, Maryland, if you're over there on the other side of the bridge. And I'd like to say a thank you to our engineer, Bruce Blanchard, for getting Martin and me set up for this interview.